are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 30th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Liliana Mason on the uncivil agreement, how politics have become our identity. Meanwhile, Republican tax cuts lead to huge CEO payments, payouts. New libertarian study doesn't say what some reporters will say it says about Medicare for all. Meanwhile, Dems announce how they plan to blow the Kavanaugh fight. And the Koch brothers are willing to fund Democrats. No duh, says Andrew Cuomo. DOJ announces Religious Liberty Task Force. Yes. Just a reminder, we kidnap children and serve them to sexual predators via our zero-tolerance immigration policy. 3D printer guns now legal. That should work out well. And Governor Cynthia Nixon of New York gets Spectrum Cable kicked out of the state. Lastly, Trump's Consumer Financial Protection SAR is giving discounts to lawbreakers. All this and more on today's program. Two things I want to touch on. We may not get them until the fun half, but I just want to flag them for people. One is that on this program, for years, we have been talking about a dynamic that has been thoroughly researched by a guy named Bill Lozonik, William Lozonik. He works at he's a professor at UMass business. I don't know if it's at the business school or he's a business professor of business at the UMass University of Massachusetts. And over the years, Lozonik has come on this program, probably overdue to have him back on. But if you go back and search our archives, two dynamics he has talked about for a long time. That is stock buybacks and the implications of those, how they mix with a change in the tax code. Both these things happened during the Reagan administration where capital gains were lowered significantly and companies were incentivized to give payment to their CEOs and board of directors and maybe other people of their C-suite to provide compensation in the form of stock options. Simultaneously, and better for the recipients of those because there's a tax benefit to getting paid in stocks versus actual wage labor or labor wages. And then the ability of corporations to buy back their own stocks. As of 35 years ago, doing that was illegal. It was considered stock manipulation. After Reagan's first term, that was no longer the case. So the dynamic here is you've now incentivized CEOs, C-suite folks, board of directors, not to necessarily improve their company, to develop a five-year long-term plan, to broaden their markets, to develop new products, to have a stable workforce. You have incentivized them only to have increases in the value of the stock. And there are a lot of ways of doing that without doing the things I just listed. One of them that's highly efficient is to simply buy back the stocks because it raises the value of those stocks. And there's a story out today that says that is exactly what the tax cuts promoted. And it is stunning. When we talk about income inequality, we talk about just extracting value out of companies. This is an incredible way in which to do that. And then, of course, the people who really suffer are ultimately the people who work for those companies and the communities in which those companies are located. We will get to that story. The other one is a story that you're undoubtedly seeing out there today, that a libertarian think tank funded by the Koch brothers is reporting that Medicare for All will cost $32.6 trillion over the next 10 years, or over a 10-year period, actually, from 2022 to 2031. It will cost the federal government that amount of money. That headline is true. But if you read into it, and we will talk about a piece that Matt Brunig wrote that explicates this, but it's fairly straightforward. It is true the federal government will pay $32.6 trillion over that 10-year period of time. However, over that same 10-year period of time, it's actually, let's just stipulate that they'll pay $32.6 trillion. There's an argument they'll pay less, but let's just stipulate that number. Over that same period of time, the cost of healthcare to everyone, to the country, not the federal government, but everybody who pays in to get health insurance, is actually $32.9 trillion. So in other words, it's going to cost this much, but you're actually going to save a certain amount of money. You're going to save $300 billion. That should be the headline. Medicare for All will save $300 billion, even with a right-wing think tank's numbers, over a 10-year period from 2022 to 2031. We will get to
that. That's a fucking good point.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
We will get to those stories in the fun half, maybe one of them at the end of the interview. And we're going to get to this clip of Rudy Giuliani in a moment. But folks, I've told you this many times before. Harry's founders know that a great shave comes down to great blades. They got to be made with sharp, durable steel that lasts. That's why they make some of the highest quality blades in the world, priced much lower than the leading brand. And they will even give you a full refund if you don't love your shave, as long as you let them know within 30 days. Look, if it takes you 28 days to figure out that your shave wasn't good, you still have another day to send the product back.
Also, you're very indecisive.
Well,
very, very Chuck Schumer.
Or
you.
You're very meticulous.
That's not Schumer. No,
Harry's
not Harry.
Stands behind the quality of their blades. They created a $13 trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. You got the weighted ergonomic handle. That's my favorite part. It's my favorite part. The five-blade razor with the lubricating strip and the trimmer blade, my second favorite part. Deal with the asymmetry of my nostrils. We've talked about this. Probably ad nauseum. It's probably nauseating people to hear about it right now. Rich lathering shave gel, a travel blade cover. You can get yours right now by going to harrys.com/majority report. Now our listeners can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You make sure you go to harrys.com/majority report to redeem your offer. Let them know I sent you to help support the show. Make sure you do that /majority report at harrys.com. Also, this is fun for me. This is fun for me, but it also, given my history with cars, is going to be a huge asset at one point. So, all right, you've all been there. Your check engine light beeps on. Is this just like there's air in the carburetor, too much air in the carburetor, or there's air in the gas tank? Or sometimes your light will go on for no reason. But sometimes it's more serious. Are you savvy enough to deal with the mechanic to go in there and have a sense of what's wrong? I mean, with all due respect to mechanics, some of them will take advantage of you. Most people have no idea why your light's on, but not anymore, thanks to Fixd. F-I-X-D. It's like a health monitor for your car. It takes just a few seconds to install it on any car made after 1996. I did it myself. Super easy. Anyone can do it. No tools required. literally like plugging in an electrical plug. Then Fix will constantly scan your vehicle for problems and tell you in plain English what's wrong with it. They also just, they measure all sorts of different other aspects. Everything that your computer in your car does, you can see it. There's even an automatic sensor that plugs into your car, connects to your smartphone via the Fix app, so you're always in the know. No more paying thousands of dollars for unnecessary car repairs. With Fix, you can tell the mechanic what you need done. You could also very easily figure out how much it should cost. That kind of confidence and control is priceless when you go in. I hooked mine up in about, literally, it took about 30 seconds. And I am monitoring my car for all sorts of different issues that go on. And I'm literally now waiting for a problem because I'm that excited about it. To have that level of confidence. And right now, honestly... I had a car that had 200,000 miles on it. If I had this device, it would have made the and it was a 2002 Subaru. And if I had this device, I would have saved myself a lot of headaches.
It's working, and it's very exciting.
Right now, you can get fixed for as low as $39 each, plus an additional 10% off when you enter the promo code MAJORITY. At listentomycar.com. That's listentomycar.com. Listentomycar.com. Enter the promo code MAJORITY. Get an additional 10% off the already discounted price. Check it out. Fixed. It's cool. Also, as you know, 2 days a week, we get Blue Apron at our house. You don't have to meal plan. You can get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. And they've got some great grilling recipes. Seared chicken, tangy barbecue sauce, juicy cheeseburgers with spicy slaw. Huh? Seriously.
I mean, everything I've had by Blue Apron is delicious.
Getting the most out of summer has never been easier. With quick and easy chef-designed recipes, pre-proportioned ingredients right delivered right to your door, Blue Apron makes dinner quick, easy, and insanely tasty. I'll be honest with you, with the recent change, not so recent, but change in my marital status, the ability to cook a home-cooked meal for my kids is a little more challenging. Blue Apron makes it possible for me, and it sends only non-GMO ingredients. Meat with no added hormones. Menu changes it based every week what's in season. You can choose 2 or 3 recipes a week, 4 if you want, based on what fits your schedule. I've had some of the best meals, honestly. Someone asked me over the weekend what my favorite meal was. And the most specific thing I could think of was a Blue Apron meal with it was a Asian dish with like round noodles and some type, I can't remember the name of it. I have the that's the thing, they send you the menu, you keep the menus, I mean not the menus, the recipes, so it's very convenient. You look through it. I put it all in a little book, like a little 3-ring binder. They don't tell you to do that. I took the liberty myself of doing it. Check out this week's menu. You get your first 3 meals free at blueapron.com/majority. That's blueapron.com/majority to get your first 3 meals free. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook. Do we have time for this sound? Brendan, we just let her know that we're going to be just 2 minutes late. So they apparently have taken Rudy Giuliani out of the cold storage that he was in. He was traveling Europe. Basically cashing in on his newfound relevance, I guess, in the national conversation, as really disturbing as that is. And he was driving around, I guess, trolling for more clients overseas, and then came back to defend the president. Remember, the one thing that these guys seem to understand is that impeachment is a political process. They are laying the groundwork to muddy the waters. Now, what is the best way for you to determine someone's guilt? Apparently, according to Pete Hegseth on Fox and Friends, it is to look at that person's nominal lawyer and check out their body language. to see if their client is or is not guilty of anything. And then Rudy Giuliani responds with, you know, that's crazy what you just said. Let me see if I can get a little bit crazier.
Schubert, I read your body language on this almost. It's almost like, I mean, come on. How much?
Pause it for one second. Incidentally, hold on, pause it, pause it. Sorry, go back. Pause it, pause it.
Having nothing
left. Sorry. Sorry about that. Okay, things got a little out of hand. It just occurs to me as I'm watching this. We're going to start that over. But Pete Hegseth says, I'm looking at your body language like this. And then what Pete Hegseth does is he crosses his arm. Now, any rudimentary understanding of body language would argue that crossing your arms is a defensive posture, like you're afraid. So you're literally protecting yourself by crossing your arms. You're insecure a little bit, and you're trying to project, but you're holding your innards in. But then that's why Hegseth, I think, quickly went like, oh, actually, no, not that.
No.
Like, more like you're open.
You're just open. Like, whatever, come what may.
Come what may. We're okay.
Practice what you preach, Pete.
Okay. So,
bad body language.
All right, so let's take this again.
Schubert, I read your body language on this almost. It's almost like, I mean, come on. How much more?
This is the theater of the absurd. The president's innocence, having done nothing wrong, has been proven over and over again. There's not a single stitch of evidence of collusion. He didn't have anything to do with Russians. He made no deals with Russians. He didn't get elected because of Russians. They may have colluded with somebody else, or with themselves, a whole bunch of them, 13 of them, 14 of them. Kind of watch the Americans, and you can watch the Russians collude. I mean, they do it for a living, and they also do other things. But he wasn't involved in
what?
It. The obstruction thing is crazy. He had a right to fire Comey. That's what it's all about. He had a right to say to Comey, give Flynn a break. There was no investigation at the time. And not only that, he didn't tell him, don't investigate him, don't prosecute him. He asked him to exercise his prosecutorial discretion because he was a good man with a great war record.
That prosecutorial discretion, ladies and gentlemen, is he's asked him not to investigate him.
Yeah, it's called discretion.
You can see
your...
all of a sudden that 1 year at BU you're always bragging about doesn't come in handy.
Can you be there professionally? Can you be professionally discreet about my crimes, please?
Listen.
Could you exercise your discretion to look the other way of my mass engagement in organized crime? Thank you.
What is he saying about the Americans had U.S. assets all the time.
Yeah, but it was with each other. Speaking of which, hey, Sam, would you like to collude on stuff?
We're going
to
collude.
Yeah, let's collude.
Man, don't you hate it when someone walks in on you colluding with yourself?
It's super embarrassing.
That's what they do for a living.
That's what they do for a living. It's just like every little Russian school child.
It's like, you'll be time, but next year you'll be doing first collusion. Must study hard.
They take those tests, those professions tests.
We're all going to work together. They're colluding.
You could maybe collude in regional government. Very poor results.
We're going to collude for a moment and call Liliana Mason, discuss with her book, Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity.
Girls are too much, and boys are too tough.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program University of Maryland professor Liliana Mason, author of Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity. Welcome to the program, Liliana.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. So let's just start with the concept of mega, I guess it's mega identities.
That's one way to say it. Yeah. Yeah. It's so this is really what the whole book is about, is that, you know, we've seen over the last few decades, I would say, sort of this realignment of social identities into partisan identities, so that our parties are now more socially distinct from each other than they used to be. So race and religion now divide our parties. And so that when we look across the aisle, we're not only just seeing partisans that we don't agree with, but we're also seeing people that are very unlike us.
Is it just race and religion, or is it also things like urban, rural, and maybe even delineated by professions on some level?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's becoming basically cultural. So it's geographical. It's education based. It can be neighborhood level based. But it's also, you can see it in these things like, different neighborhoods drive different kinds of cars, and you can predict from the number of pickup trucks in the neighborhood, the probability they're going to vote for a Republican politician. Google Earth actually did this. Someone did this on Google Earth and actually, predicted with like 90% probability how each district was going to vote based on the cars that they saw through the Google Earth camera. But grocery store, we go to different grocery stores, we drive different cars, we watch different television shows. TiVo did a study in 2012 where they actually looked at the top 10 most favorite shows for Democrats and Republicans, and there was not a single show on both lists.
So, okay. So, well, let's I guess start with, like, how does that type of sorting happen?
Well, it started really with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and generally created this large group of conservative Southern Democrats who were very unhappy about the Civil Rights Act. But we are very strongly partisan, and our parties are, a part of who we think we are, and often it's something that, our parents taught us. And so, changing party is very much like converting to a different religion. It's a really hard and rare thing to do. So what happened essentially is that gradually, over a generation, those unhappy Southern Democrats moved away from the Democratic Party, and then their children could move and become Republicans. So there was a long period of time where we had kind of a lot of these cross-cutting identities, because it wasn't clear which party to vote for based on your racial attitudes. And then starting in the 1980s, the Christian Coalition came along and decided to become, overtly political, participate in politics, and decided the Republican Party was the right place to do that. And so their entire platform was incorporated into the Republican Party platform by the year 2000. So we had these two movements sort of happening at the same time. And then, of course, it doesn't help that we also have a diversifying media where we can go just see our side's point of view and say, and they'll tell us, this is the side that you're supposed to be on. If you're watching this show, this is your party. The cues are very clear, and you absolutely cannot be a partisan from the other side.
So the media, the stratification of the media has become an accelerant, but the two primary drivers of this were basically race and religion.
Yeah. In terms of really, really strong identities that make us feel like people are not like us, race and religion are some of the most basic and powerful identities, particularly race in American politics. It's been a dividing line in American politics forever. And so it's the type of thing that can actually, cause people to rethink who they are and who their friends are and who they should be voting for.
And just as I'm saying that, I mean, it occurs to me that it's really racism and a religious fundamentalism, right? Because it's obviously like race and religion existed prior to the Christian right getting into politics and the Civil Rights Act. Race and religion existed. Is that racists took issue with the changes, and fundamentalists exerted their political will, and they, and the fundamentalism themselves is exclusionary.
Yes, that's part of it. But the other part is that, and this is really important, is that there's always been racial and religious conflict in American politics, but this is the first time that it's lined up with party. So we haven't had a situation since really like the Civil War where the sort of the racists and the super religious people are on one side and then everyone else is on the other side. The party divide is a really powerful one because we get to essentially vote for our racial, vote against our racial outgroups and vote against our religious outgroups. And we didn't really have that power before. There was much more of a sort of mixed electorate within each party.
All right. Well, so and just to describe how this alignment, I mean, it just reinforces people want to be part of their group. And the real problem is just that we're so well. OK, well, before we get to that. How do you go from the racial impetus and the religious impetus to sort of sort ourselves out political? And then how does that go down to things like the car that we drive and TV show? Like, where is the connective tissue there?
Yeah, right. So I mean, I would say that's actually cultural. So, you know, the types of people who tend to be extremely, you know, fundamentalists, Christian, and very, you know, strongly identified as white are generally culturally different than people who identify as you know, members of different religions or not religious at all, or and also people of you know, other races. So there are going to be cultural differences if we create this partisan divide that's essentially, you know, saying this is a racial group and a religious group that's relatively homogeneous, you know, white Christians, white rural Christians at this point. And then there's sort of this other group that has to take on all the other identities in American society. There are obviously going to be cultural differences between those two groups. They're not going to like the same type of entertainment. They're not going to be as concerned about the environment, right? So the number of Priuses also tells you the partisanship of a neighborhood. And so they tend to think about the world in different ways, and often even, you know, intentionally spite the other side in their choices, you know, like the idea of rolling coal when, you know, people who are intentionally polluting, using their trucks to pollute the environment, at, you know, damaging their own cars in order to do so, just to sort of, you know, hurt the feelings of the other side.
We should just say rolling coal is like where you mod your pickup truck essentially to blow black smoke out the back of the car. Mm-hmm. And
it's not good for the car.
It's not good for the car. It obviously is not great if you're driving behind it. It's probably not very good for the environment, but it really is just a way to troll the libs, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yep. Let's talk a little bit about how much that happens the other way too, because you write that it's that the Republican Party is so homogeneous that it sort of supercharges this effect. Explain how that works.
Right. So this is really based in intergroup conflict, social psychology literature from the 1970s, and this is an old idea. That, you know, if you're a member of two different groups, and you know, basically all the members of group one are also members of group two, then you're going to be relatively intolerant of people who are outsiders, because you're only exposed to people who are very familiar to you all the time. But if you're a member of group one and only like 10% of the group one members are also in group two that you're also in, then you spend a lot of time with people unlike you. And I kind of think about the Democratic and Republican parties this way. Most Democrats under the party umbrella are you know, understand that they have co-partisans who are racially and religiously different from them. Because, you know, the Democratic Party is something like 56% white, 19% black, 16% Hispanic, something like that. So every Democrat knows that there are people within the party that are racially and religiously different from them. Whereas in the Republican Party, most of the people in the Republican Party are white and Christian. And so it's a lot easier to think about people who are not white and not Christian as being really, really outsiders. You don't have a common identity with them. It's not like you have some common party umbrella that you can say, well, at least we need to work together to get, this and this passed. Instead, it's more like I don't ever see those people and I don't know who they are and I can easily dehumanize them because they're not part of my political life and they're not part of my cultural and social life.
So, I mean, the basic fact of being exposed to other people will fundamentally, I guess, it sort of seems obvious, I guess, when we start to think about it, but there's some social science behind it. We'll just open up your ability to both compromise and, I guess, to see value in opposing views.
Yeah, it's a theory that's gone back to the 1950s called contact theory. It basically just means if you have contact with somebody who's unlike you, then you start to like them more and people who are like them. And there's been a lot of controversy about it, but recently there's been some work looking kind of at the history of all the literature that's tested it, finding that it kind of stands up. It's pretty robust, and there are things that are kind of promising, like you don't actually have to know a person personally. You can have a friend of a friend be an out-group member, and that increases your tolerance for them. You can see sympathetic outgroup members in the media, and that can increase your tolerance for them. So it doesn't even have to be all that strong, but just having that contact can make you at least give you some sense of like, this is a human being, with thoughts and feelings and families and, normal human things.
I mean, I think at least on this program, and we see it, whether it's a Republican senator who decides that marriage equality is okay because he has a gay son, or something to that effect. I mean, we see this happen quite a bit, it seems to me, at least in the context of the Republican side. It seems, just statistically speaking, the Democrats are already there. So let's talk a little bit about the concept of what happens when you mix this sort of sorting with political knowledge.
Yeah, so this is the depressing part, that when what we know is that people who are interested in politics tend to look for information that they agree with already, and they try to avoid information that they don't agree with. And if they are forced to spend time consuming information that they disagree with, the people who are the most politically knowledgeable are the ones who will spend the longest time reading it, because they are counter-arguing every single thing that they read. And so it's almost like the more information that you have that's in defense of your party, the more like intellectual ammunition you have to counter-argue everything that you don't want to think is true. And so when I say political knowledge, this can be incorrect information, right? It's not just like, general knowledgeability, but the more you are listening to and learning about politics from whatever source, the easier it is for you to reject arguments that you're wrong.
Now, okay. So now I have to say this in defense of, because that's exactly what our project is here, right? I mean on this show on a daily basis, it is to inform people of politics, and we do it with we do it specifically from the left. Is there symmetry between these two? We talk about this dynamic, but is it the same regardless of your political views or your partisanship? And if so, if any two given people who have political knowledge perform in the same way in terms of like, oh, here's a story. I'm a liberal and I'm reading a story about why Medicare for All is bad. And I'm a conservative and I'm reading a story about why Medicare for All is good. Even if those two people will spend the same amount of time reading that piece, right? Because they're both politically informed. Are there as many people on one side or the other who will do that? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, do we?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, so maybe you can rephrase what I'm saying in a more digestible way. But I just wonder, like, it's one thing to say that the more political knowledge you have, the more time you will spend reading a specific piece to debunk it. But my experience is, and you know, this could be, we can talk about confirmation bias in a moment, but my experience is that on the right, there's a lot less questioning, even from a policy standpoint, and that they're not just simply interested in policy as much, and that they're not as adept at taking apart arguments because they don't spend as much time doing it. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's my confirmation bias.
No. So there's a couple ways to think about it. One is that what I've found in some recent work that I've been doing is that, in fact, Republicans tend to be more sensitive to not having the right set of identities for their party. So, you know, if you are, you know, white and Christian and rural and male, then you are very strongly identified as Republican. But if you're missing any one of those, your identification as Republican drops quickly. So the people who identify strongly as Republican tend to be people who fit this social, the sort of perfect social mold. And you know, sort of what I was saying before about having, you know, this really homogeneous set of identities, one of the dangerous things about that is that essentially, you know, when you win or lose, when your party wins or loses, you get the sense that your racial and religious and cultural and geographical, all of these other parts of your identity are also losing. And that's devastating. And because if it's just your party that loses, but, you know, your racial group is fine and your religious group is fine because you have all these cross-cutting identities, then the loss doesn't hurt so much. But if your loss takes up a huge portion of your sense of who you are, you have to avoid that at all costs just for, like, your own psychological well-being. It's just a really brutal thing to feel all those things be losers. And so, in a sense, one of the things we've seen, especially in political conversation lately, is that everything is framed as which party won this policy debate. And so, you know, government is trying to make legislation to do this, this, and this. Who is this a win for? Is this a win for Democrats, or is it a win for Republicans? And to the extent that it's very dangerous to lose, it feels very, very dangerous psychologically to lose if all of your identities are crammed into this one party identity, then you're going to resist losing. And if it means that you have to, you know, find your way around, logically around something that it's really hard to get around logically or intellectually, you still need to do it in order to protect yourself. And so this is the way that I think about it is that, you know, essentially as long as we're covering, you know, policy debates as win or lose for one party or another, it's going to be very threatening to people who are strongly identified as partisan. And Republicans in particular have this, you know, this identity that's so all encompassing that it feels really, really terrible to lose. And then the second thing that I would say is that there's a book by Matt Grossman and Dave Hopkins called Asymmetric Politics that actually finds that Republicans tend to be more about sort of ideological purity. And by ideological, they mean just like, are you a good member of the group? Like, are you a good conservative? And Democrats tend to be much more about like actual things on the ground, getting little things done. Like, you know, make sure you fix this for this group. Make sure you fix this for this constituency. You know, like, let's get some stuff on the ground. Let's get our hands dirty. And Republicans just tend to be sort of more lofty and sort of less connected to actual policy when they think about politics. So I think those two things together would say that it's in Republicans' interest, and they're already sort of oriented that way, to find a way to counter-argue something, both psychologically and just sort of the way that they tend to go about politics.
So all their eggs are in one basket, and the idea of losing is just watching that basket fall and all the eggs breaking, and they'll even kidnap children to get to save that basket. I mean, just to use
basically, yeah. I mean, if it's your own sense of self, that's the most important thing that you have. And there was a study that found in 2012 after Obama won the presidential election, Republicans reported feeling more sad than Bostonians after the Boston Marathon bombing, and then parents of young children after the Sandy Hook shootings.
Wow.
There's just really intense emotional responses to losing.
What role does class play in this sorting? Does it play any?
This is a really interesting question, because for all sort of all of the data that we have, which basically goes back to about 1950, if you look at sort of the span of time, people who call themselves working class have always been generally more Democratic. And people who call themselves, you know, middle to upper class have generally been Republican. And this trend has, you know, it sort of moves up and down over time, but generally that trend has held since 1950. And I was just looking at it a few months ago and realized in 2016, for the first time, both groups there's zero difference between party in both working class and middle or upper class. So class is gone as a party dividing line. It used to be there. And now it's no longer there. It's almost like class has become a cross-cutting identity, except that because of racial differences within class, it's really hard to sort of mobilize, you know, a particular class-based group, because each class-based group is racially diverse, or particularly working class people are racially diverse.
So and that changed in 2016.
Yeah, for the first time, there was no partisan difference.
All right. So no partisan difference in terms of class in 2016. And it's race that is. So what does that mean in terms of the way that people relate to class? Does that mean that class is sort of like there? I guess we should stipulate that the way that people perceive themselves, what class people perceive themselves, is probably like where they would be. I mean, can we assume that people self-identify relatively accurately?
Not exactly. Most people call themselves middle class. Even like very wealthy people tend to call themselves middle class. Working class people more often call themselves working class, but everybody likes to think that they're middle class. However, the difference, I think, is that the working class people who were racially mixed, the only working class people who moved to the Republican Party were white working class people. And that's probably, I haven't gone through all of the data on it, but I'm guessing that's part of the reason why the partisan class divide disappeared, was because white working class people moved to the Republican Party.
So does that mean that their whiteness trumps, forgive the pardon, the pun, their, at least in their minds, their, I guess, racial awareness is greater than their class awareness?
So this is, whatever identity is most threatened in your life is the one that's going to be the most important. And this is one of the things that I think Trump did really effectively in the 2016 campaign, was point out that, you know, white identity is something to be worried about. And there are outgroup members that are, you know, non-white people that are threatening you and that are trying to steal, you know, your place in society and your jobs and whatever else. And by making that salient, by talking about it a lot, he effectively can move people's feelings of which group am I most motivated to defend, right? If it used to be working class people, by talking a lot about race, he made it white people. And it's not forever, right? That's not necessarily going to be forever. It can easily go back. It's just whatever group is the most threatened at any given moment is the one we tend to focus on. So he did a good job of focusing people on race in 2016, and I think continues to.
And they also did the same thing with religion, right? I mean, he went out there, even though he's not considered a religious guy, he kept saying, I'm going to protect religious freedom. And in fact, today... the DOJ set up a religious liberty task force to protect the infringement upon religion. And I think Jeff Sessions literally said, you know, we're going to prevent people from having to pray in their basements, as if this was, you can't pray if you're Christian in this country. I presume that's who he's referring to. If that's the case, how does that work on the left of center? I mean, it's always seemed to me that the right has constitutionally, like something intrinsic in the right, is a sense of aggrievement, of in like of fear, of like a Masada complex almost. Like, it, you know, maybe it shifts from the gay people are coming to steal our marriage, or you know, to steal our genders, or the Muslims are coming to take something from us, or you know, the professors, the pointy headed professors. It's always like they're at the walls threatening us. Mm-hmm. Who they are is different. It changes and ebbs and flows. But there's always someone who's crashing the gates in some fashion. And they're on the inside of the gates. What's the analog for the left, broadly speaking, or the Democrats?
Well, yeah. So you know, just first of all, I'll go back to what I just said, which is like, you know, the identity that is the most threatened is the one that you're going to pay attention to. So as long as there's a threat, people will feel motivated to get up and vote and fight for their party. So it's an effective political strategy, particularly if the people that you're asking to vote for you don't necessarily agree with your policies, right? If your policies are not popular among, you know, large swaths of your electorate, and in fact, there has been work, there's a book called Ideology in America that's great, that talks about essentially how America is on average a liberal, holds liberal issue positions, but identifies on average as conservative. So there's a significant portion of self-identified conservatives who actually hold relatively liberal issue positions, which means for the Republican Party, they need to make sure that they're not talking just about policy, because that's not what's going to motivate people, because they don't necessarily agree with those policies. What's going to motivate people is a sense of identity threat. So that sort of, you know, that type of rhetoric is very activating and can get people going in a way that, you know, the policy positions won't. Democrats, on the other hand, the majority of the country calls themselves conservatives but holds the same policies as Democrats. So what Democrats are inclined to do is to run on policies, because that's what the people want, right? That's what the majority of Americans actually do want, these relatively, you know, not super far left, but generally to the left of center policy outcomes. And so they have in sort of intrinsically different motivations for campaigning and even for governing, right? It is in the Republicans' interest to remind people that they are constantly under threat, because that gets their identity, you know, focused part of their brain going.
And so, is it the case that, I mean, there's been a big uptick, and I guess we probably won't see, you know, get a full sort of data set until after this election, but they're anecdotally, and there's some data to support the idea that women have become much more active on the Democratic side. I mean, which is not to say they weren't active before, but that to the extent that there's been any like increase in activity, it has come largely from women. How much of having a guy who's been accused of a dozen, at least, you know, assaults on women, and the sort of how much of that is at play here when we see that, like this idea of and on top of which, you know, a clear threat to abortion rights and whatnot. I mean, how much of that do you think is at play when we see heightened activity by women and watching Hillary Clinton lose? I mean, I don't know what all the factors are, but how much of that is in play there, do you think?
Well, and I think also there was, you know, plenty of, you know, covert and overt examples of misogyny during the 2016 campaign that, you know, that probably got a lot of women started thinking about, you know, their identity as a woman is being threatened. And so they're going to start thinking of themselves as women now. And think about the interests of women, and think about the interests of their group, and you know who's in their group, and how important it is to make sure that their group is politically represented. And so you know, I think that the election definitely made that identity salient. And it's only become more salient since then. I mean, even the Me Too movement, right? It's this sort of constant barrage of, you know, statements about you know, women's place. There's, you know, plenty of Republicans are feeling much more comfortable saying generally misogynist things. And you know, it's, again, this is, you know, I identify as a woman, I identify as a college professor, I identify as a bunch of different things. But if somebody starts telling me that, you know, threatening me as a woman, then I'm going to pay a lot of attention to that group of people. And that I think is part of the way this is working. And the other part of the way it's working is that among the, you know, Republican Party, this gender gap is growing, and that's partially because, you know, women don't feel completely represented necessarily by the sort of, you know, rhetoric of the Republican Party, which is generally male and you know, traditionalist and patriarchal. And so the, you know, there is this sense that women don't necessarily feel supported by the Republican Party. The women in the Democratic Party are extremely excited and active because they feel like they need to get involved. And so it's almost like this perfect storm for a really large gender gap to open up.
Okay, so how do we deal with this? And I guess, you know, and I guess, I mean, I should be more specific, because I imagine there are some people who are like, well, there's something inherently problematic with this type of sorting. And I'm not convinced that that's the case. What do you have an opinion on that? Like, I mean, is this what, why is this necessarily a bad thing? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of, you know, bad rhetoric out of it, and bad policy can come out of it. But why isn't, you know, if I was to say, like, look, there are people who, for whatever reason, don't like the idea that, you know, black people and brown people and women people are going to get opportunities that will, you know, arguably come at the expense of my race or gender, and I want to stop that from happening because I this is what my opinion is, and politics are the way that we sort this out. Why is that? Are you of the opinion that that's inherently bad? Because from my perspective, I should just say that, like, I just want to figure this out. So, as a partisan on some level, that I can, you know, I can win. But I mean, that's, you know, I've put my cards on the table. Like, I'm curious as to how do I see this reality and then make it so that my policy outcomes happen. But is there something intrinsically bad to this dynamic?
No. So I mean, it's good and bad, because, you know, having this arrangement of essentially one party that is the party of traditional hierarchy, white, male, Christian hegemony, right? Having one party that's that and the other party that's everybody else, that is, first of all, it doesn't happen very often in American politics. And second of all, the fact that it doesn't happen very often or hasn't happened in a very long time means that we actually have a party that's working for things like social justice, right, which we haven't really had before. So that's good, because, you know, people who need work on behalf of social justice now have a party that might lose sometimes, but at least when they win, they get, you know, they get the things that they need and things that they're participating in politics for.
Theoretically.
So in that sense, you're right, theoretically, if they win. So in that sense, it's good. The way that it's bad is that it's creating this absolute cavern between the parties, which is bad for democracy. It's bad for, you know, our ability to compromise. It's bad for our ability to, you know, think clearly about, you know, the risks that we're taking or the things that we're doing, or even hold our elected officials accountable. And that's where it gets dangerous, because if we can't hold our elected officials accountable because we're just always going to vote for them no matter what so that we always win, then we, you know, we're basically just not doing democracy anymore. We're just playing the game to see who wins. And so, you know, ultimately, hopefully, we could get past this point and say, you know, we're playing the game to help people, to make sure that we have good legislation, to make sure that the country is running well, to make sure that people are well represented. But right now, we're engaging in politics just to win. And right. So that's where I think it's dangerous.
Okay. And just to be clear, though, but who's the we when you say that? Like, because I'm not convinced that everybody is. Like, you know, like, because I think my sense is that the center to the left, right, represented, you know, at least nominally by the Democrats, have not engaged in this activity for as long and as intensely as the Republicans. And from my perspective, they're not engaging in this as intensely and as early as Republicans was of no benefit to stopping this phenomena. So what is the solution? Because I'm not even convinced that when you say we want these broad, you know, democratic outcomes, I'm not convinced. I don't know who the we you're referring to is, right? Like, honestly, right. Like, I think you'll find a lot of people within the Republican Party who would be like, well, wait a second. I mean, that's all well and good, but not if it comes at the expense of these things. I mean, I don't.
Right,
think,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, but I don't think like, you know, the broader goals, I just don't think are universally shared. And so what is the strategy?
Yes. So first of all, I think you're right. And in fact, I can just give you an anecdote, which is in teaching the classes that I teach a class on partisanship and democracy. And in teaching my classes, I haven't changed my lectures, but it's starting in 2016, really 2017, the same lecture that I gave in 2015 started to be seen as partisan, right? So because I'm saying these are the seven requirements of a functioning democracy, and there are things like a free press and, you know, freedom of speech and all kinds of, you know, things that have become politicized by the current president. So you're right that the we is not everyone is agreeing on what we should be doing. But when I say we, I'm actually just talking about, you know, people who are pro-democracy. You know, the idea of being a functional democracy is it requires these things. And there are people who don't want those things. And in fact, in 2016, I looked at some of the 2016 data, electoral data, that found that Republicans were significantly less willing to compromise than Democrats were in 2016. So,
and Democrats, and my understanding is that Democrats have actually moved towards less compromising over the past couple of years.
Yeah, they weren't extremely willing to compromise, but they were more willing to compromise than Republicans. So this is, you know, I think this is a big problem, and really the one of the only ways that I see this changing is sort of to look at it like the possibly like the Democratic Party of the 1950s and 60s, not the Democratic Party, but look at the Republicans that way and say, like, is there a place where there could be a group that sort of naturally separates off and creates some new cross-cutting identities? So is there a, you know, anti-alt-right segment of the Republican Party that would separate off? Or is there just like a pro-Trump portion of the Republican Party that would separate off? And which actually would be really beneficial, because then we wouldn't all necessarily know who we're supposed to be voting for, and we would have all these, you know, cross-cutting cues, and we would have, you know, a harder time knowing who wins and who loses every single time. So that's one way that things could get better in terms of democracy. In terms of winning for Democrats, you know, I don't want to say to play the same game in terms of, you know, talking about victimhood and threat all the time. You know, where there is real threat, it's important to notice it, and it's important to talk about it. There are real threats, but you know, making up fake threats and making people feel unsafe in order to gain electoral advantage, I think, is something that is generally not good for democracy as a whole.
So, I mean, if I hear you correctly, it's basically like we're hoping for a turn in the weather.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so the, you know, I like, that's the thing, is that it sounds like really there's no options for people, the we version. I mean, I know. I mean, we have you know, some would argue. I mean, what is your perspective? Do you think that, like, for instance, based upon what you told us about what happened with the way that people identify in terms of class in the 2016 election, do you think that having, you know, someone like Bernie Sanders going out and raising class awareness, how helpful do you think that would be? You know, I guess, in terms of this particular project?
I mean, I don't think it's all that helpful, honestly. Class is not a very strong identity, unless you have some, you know, giant threat to it, which I think unions helped with, right? Unions helped to organize people and help them understand that there's a threat and you can fight it. But just, you know, sort of broadly talking about class, you end up activating people who are racially divided, and racial divides are more powerful than class divides. The one thing that I would say in terms of optimism is that, you know, millennials and younger are generally not like this. And, there are plenty of young, you know, young white guys in alt-right groups, but, but in general, they're, you know, millennials are a very diverse generation, and they tend to have gone to school with people who don't look exactly like them, and they don't think a lot of these things are as big a deal as you know, as the baby boomers do, and so they're, you know, and there's a huge, massive gender gap in terms of partisanship for millennials. It's like 50 points or 60 points or something gigantic. So, you know, if only millennials were voting, then this wouldn't be as big of a problem. So, you know, that is sort of one of the solutions, is to make sure that millennials and younger generations are politically activated and understand that, you know, there's a threat to them. And in fact, I think that's sort of what the Parkland kids were doing, is to say, you know, my identity as a student is threatened. I feel unsafe as a student. And so I'm going to become politically active because the threat that's coming at me is because I'm sitting in a classroom. And so I'm going to become politically active in order to protect myself. And so there are things that are, you know, real responses to real threats that can be really motivating. And I think as long as it's motivating on behalf of, you know, not on behalf of hatred of someone else, but instead on behalf of, you know, trying to raise up the people that you're motivating, then I think that there is some hope for kind of what, you know, what the future will bring.
Yeah, interesting. Liliana Mason, the book is Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break and head into the fun half in just a moment. Should we talk about the let's talk about the, because you're going to see a lot of talk about this Medicare for All. And you may not, because of the nature of our media, you may see the AP story before you see Matt Bruneg's story, just by the very nature of our media.
You need to adjust your Twitter feed if that's the case.
You need to, exactly. That is, you know what? There's some truth to that. But then, you know, we're going to fall prey to what we just heard about. I mean, you know, from my perspective, I'm interested in this to how do, you know, what can we learn about where there's a weakness here? Now, I think there's a lot of room for, like, this is a good, you know, what Liliana Mason was talking about is a good reason for why you would want a parliamentary system of government. Because I think there's a certain inevitability, look, that these people are going to be separated, and the people are going to have different, you know, I guess, agendas. And you can either hope to disaggregate some of those identities that people cling to, or you can just say people are going to have their identities, and let's just have enough distinct parties that no single one of those can do it alone. and they've got to sort of compromise with others. So, but did you want to weigh in, guys, on this? Because I know, I mean, the no.
I mean, I have a lot of thoughts. I mean, I think it's evidence of how class consciousness is at an all-time low in yes. this country. Like, when you have people identifying as working class who are voting for Trump and they like own a small business and are exploiting other people's labor, but they think they're working class because they have these like cultural signifiers. That's just it's not reality. And
well, I mean, according to her data, we'll just stipulate her data for the time being. When people identify as middle class, a lot of times they're not. Not a lot of times, but sometimes. But she said in terms of working class, and I don't know if you heard this, but she said generally they're accurately describing themselves.
In terms yeah. of earnings.
In terms of earnings. Like in class, terms of what they do.
I it's mean, not just about your do. Earnings. It's right. about your relationship to...
Right, right.
I don't want to use too much jargon
no,
here.
No, I understand. That they are...
It's a social relationship.
Wage earners. They're wage earners. I mean, I she may not know what working class means, but presumably when I asked if people self-identify correctly, she said that working class tends to more than people who identify
as middle class. Oh, I agree with that. For sure. For sure. It's just like... all this culture wars bullshit, it seems to have taken over as a result of class politics going down and down and down. And like, maybe, I think, if we had more class consciousness and if we had a real labor party that represented the interests of workers, who are, of course, locked in an eternal struggle against the bosses, it would be a lot more effective. And I think that is part of, that's how you unite the working class, you know, because the working class is divided along lines of race. It's divided along lines of gender. It's divided, stuff like homophobia. This is all stuff that benefits the capitalist class because it keeps sure. workers apart and it keeps them even in different political parties, maybe. Although I think, the importance of white working class voters in Trump's victory has been greatly overblown.
I also think, for what it's worth, I thought even on her own terms, like, I think at least somebody like David Ferris, who I would read as more of like a, you know, conventional, solid, progressive, has a more of an understanding.
David Ferris.
The guy who wrote the book on how Democrats can win.
Right.
I was a little concerned just, I mean, I share... you know, the perspective of class is not an identity, but really a specific economic function. I had some technical quibbles, but I thought even in her own terms, I was kind of like, well, if Democrats don't break some norms and get a lot more aggressive, I don't think there's a way of saving she's talking about. Right?
I don't think she said anything different from that.
Yeah.
I think she just said it's unfortunate.
Right.
I mean, I just think, right. like, you know, she was studying right. the phenomena more than offering a prescription.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I
suggested, like, you're just basically waiting for the weather to change.
Right.
And she was like, yeah.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is I think at least someone like David Ferris has a little bit more of like,
oh,
we need to make that weather.
Oh,
we need to build
yeah.
a weather machine.
Oh, no. Right? I don't know that she would disagree.
I just think that that's where.
But I think the most effective
it
thing
might just be
is just waiting for people to, a lot of people to pass away.
Right.
That's.
Although I think that is where, like it or not, and I thought she was way too dismissive of the class stuff, because I do think if you just, the alt-right is proving that there's always going to be a market for culture war politics and racism and sexism. And so it's not just going to be as simple as like, because that becomes its own demographic determinism argument, which I'm just not, if we're waiting for people to die off. And we're putting our stock
in millennials
being.
I think she's just looking at the data and saying that people who self-identify as white, as Christian, and as
need to die.
And, no, as white and Christian and male. As white and Christian and male have congealed in one party.
Right.
And
well, that's
obvious. All of those identities align.
Yes.
And I think her point about unions was that unions made people more conscious of their class,
Right.
And could also then say, deliver the argument, you're being threatened.
Right.
Because as a function of your class.
Right.
But where did this come from? Like, where did unions come from in the first place? It wasn't like a top-down ideology given to workers. This is something that people formed through collective struggle. Like, it's not magic. And, you know, it could form again. And people are trying. And I'm seeing a lot of positive signs everywhere that people are gaining class consciousness beyond being Democrats or Republicans.
Right.
And
they lost it in 2016.
That's why an independent.
You may have been in the restroom when she said 2016 is the first time she's seen that class consciousness drop relative to their affiliation and become subservient to their white Christianness.
Well, I think the big class story in 2016 was Bernie Sanders. You know, he came out of nowhere. He did well. He'd been around a long time, but he did way better than anybody expected him to do. And
in the Democratic Party.
Yeah. And the success and the energy that we're seeing is not because it's not because liberals have shamed people into changing their minds. I think it's because folks like, I mean, I don't want to give Bernie all the credit, but the movements that Bernie came out of and the movement that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out of are bringing class consciousness back, and they're dragging, at least, you know, on the left side, like the right, there are class enemies. They're probably never going to be on our side. But on the left, they're bringing class consciousness back, and they're dragging politics back from culture to something much more productive and material.
There's always the 1 or 2% that, and, you know, for the same reason that Trump's margin actually slightly went up with Hispanic and African Americans over Romney, there's always the 1 or 2, literally could be as low as that percentage point, but in geographically significant areas, that bought the scam about him being a populist.
Oh, yeah, there's the slice of swing voters that went from Obama to Trump.
But I think basically what she's saying is correct. Like, yes, the Republican Party is the white identity politics party.
Absolutely.
They firmed up their identity with Trump, who's the perfect expression of their politics.
I also don't know how sustainable it is that class disappears as an issue. Like, I think that might be, that might have been the case in 2016 because they were heavily appealed to on that, like she said, Trump
was able to activate
when a part of your identity is under attack, also, that makes it the most important part of
also,
your identity. But I don't think
he
that's
had something to play off of. Was look, the last president was black,
right? I mean, and the next one is
time,
a woman.
You know, it's like time to pull the fire alarm, white guys.
And so I don't think it's sustainable. I think class identity.
Well, I think that's her point too about the millennials, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Because it's going to age out. But
and the Democrats had no alternative. Like, the Republican Party has unified class politics and identity politics because they are on the side of the ruling class and they are on the side of white males, right, Christian straight males or whatever, whereas the Democrats have been playing this delicate game for a while now where they have to sort of pay lip service to class politics, but that's not their main thing.
Okay, all right, well, let me talk about this this Mercatus study, which is getting promoted. Mercatus,
People's Policy Project, is unavailable due to requests, by the way, because of this story.
Wow. Okay. All right. So since you can't get it from them directly right now, that's a good sign. That's a good sign. He just broke the internet. Because what's happening is, if you go to Google News right now, and Matt, why don't you do that? Go to Google News right now. I'm just gonna guess that if you go into Google News right now, you will see, let's see, what do we got here? Scroll down. Is there anything on there about the Medicaid? It was like a top story for a little bit. Okay, maybe.
Here it is. Bernie's. Way Fox is reporting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, here it is.
Yeah, look it up.
Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill estimated to cost $32.6 trillion dollars. New study
says. Get that duddy.
And that is how you will see this. You may not see Bernie Sanders' name there, but you will see will cost the government $32.6 trillion. However, and just to reiterate what I said earlier, this is a study on what the federal government will pay between 2022 and 2031. This is all based on projections. But let's just stipulate that the projections are right, because Brunig would argue, actually, some of the projections are a little bit too loosey-goosey, right? Like, they're talking about how much it would cost, administrative costs would be for the federal government. And Mercatus says that they will be 6%. But if you look at Medicare's costs, they're closer to 2%. So in other words, 2 cents on every dollar that is spent on Medicare goes to administration. The other 98 cents go towards health care. In the private sector, I think it's something like 13 to 20%, essentially. Actually, it's 20% administrative and profits and whatnot. And then 80% is for health care. Forget that Mercatus may be overestimating how much it will cost the federal government to administer this. Just even accept their numbers. They are estimating what it's going to cost the federal government. But here's the point of a Medicare for All. You don't compare what the federal government is spending today with what it's going to spend in 2022 if you institute Medicare for All. Those aren't the only important figures. The important figures are, what do we as a nation spend on healthcare? Because I may not spend that much in taxes on healthcare now. I pay a little bit payroll taxes, you know, 2%, 3% on Medicare taxes. But I'll pay a lot more on taxes if it's Medicare for All. However, what I won't be doing is paying out copays. I won't be paying premiums. I won't be paying for any of that other stuff. And so the other stuff, the stuff that I'm spending as a private individual, I don't care. If I'm going to get good health insurance, I don't care if I've got to pay taxes to get it or I've got to pay private entities to get it. I just want good health insurance. I would also like the bonus of not having to worry about losing it. That's one of the benefits of Medicare for All. I would also like the benefit of not having to worry about negotiating with my insurance company and sending in claims and paying $4 bills and $32 bills. And, you know, because my daughter got, you know, her blood checked and now I got 14 different entities that I've got to pay. But let's just stay on the expenditures. On the expenditure side, this same study, they bury it because they didn't want reporters to report it. But this same study that says that while the federal government will be paying $32.6 trillion, the nation's expense for health insurance, which would be the federal government plus what we spend as individuals in the private sector, will actually be $300 billion less over that same time. So Brunig's headline is Mercatus study, instead of study shows it's going to cost $32.6 trillion over 10 years, it's that Mercatus study finds that Medicare for All saves $300 billion over those 10 years. And that's the whole point that Bernie was arguing throughout the entire campaign about Medicare for All. Your taxes are going to go up. But the amount of money your average American expends on health insurance is going to go down.
Oh, I just told you
about the example from Denmark that I did. I had to do in a sociology course in college. And at first, like, the top line of your taxes you paid were like, from an especially American years, you're like, whoa, forget that, no matter how left you are. But then you went down the list from healthcare to electricity, and you basically, yeah, you came out net positive across
and
the board.
Look, who doesn't want
higher
spend,
quality
who
services?
Who doesn't want to pay one thing?
Right.
Once, you know, either right. have it taken out of my paycheck
right.
or go and pay disparate things all the right. time. It's just
right.
from a, like a, like a.
Your life was far more efficient,
oh
too.
Oh, that's and I just saying. Saw a correction from People's Policy Project. They say there was a copy paste error in the spreadsheet and the savings is actually $2.054 trillion.
Oh, okay. So it's that much more cheaper.
Way to go for precision, you pricks.
But if you don't include a whole bunch of people like drawing a profit from, you know, the delivering of these services, how is it going to be efficient?
What about the existential meaning that people derive?
Exactly.
Yeah. What about
and we should also add, under Medicare for All, everybody has health insurance. You're going to save,
totally unfair,
as a nation, over $2 trillion in healthcare costs, yet you're going to be insuring far more people.
Yeah, but then you can't carry out a eugenicist class war against the poor. So where's the fun in that?
There's also that. I mean, we're going to have to adjust. People are going to have to adjust.
People also don't have the very deeply existentially fulfilling moments of spending hours on the phone arguing with their insurance representatives.
Some of my funnest times were capitalism.
I know you enjoy it.
We're arguing about what kind of
everybody else would be like. You know, it's not the main thing, but it's so great that we don't have to haggle with these insurance companies anymore. And Sam's like, I actually kind of miss
the whole
terrorizing Barbara in accounts.
The anesthesia investigation I did when I got my last colonoscopy was, I think,
that was a crazy thing.
It was one of the more interesting things that I've been engaged in.
But how much better would it be?
I'm willing not to do that again.
Are you willing to just let go of that so everybody can just have their anesthesia?
I've done it once. I feel like I've checked that off my bucket list.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. We got to take a quick break. We're going to go into the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support to continue day in, day out. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com as a way of saying thank you. What we do is we give you extra content mostly every day, just about every day. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, not the weekends. And we do so for a handful of change a day, not even a handful, like a couple of fingers. You could pinch it between two fingers easily and have maybe room to get, I don't know what else, probably not much else. I mean, things are expensive today. If you want access to the fun half, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will work something out for you. Always don't forget to, you can support this program by buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's great coffee, free shipping. Check it out. You will like it. Go to our sponsors. Check the liner notes of our podcast to find out what deals we have for us today. Today is Monday, which means that tomorrow on July 31st, is there 31 days?
Yep, that's correct.
July 31st is a Tuesday. I should also just say, as a house cleaning thing, on Thursday and Friday, I'm going to be broadcasting live from New Orleans, as they say.
Try to interview
Netroots
James Carville.
There's going to be some interesting people there.
Try to interview Carville, man.
I will try.
He is my favorite old line Democratic hack by far.
AOC will be there.
I've heard enough from her. She's over.
Elizabeth Warren will be there. We did a story on Jackson, Mississippi. Is it Jackson, Mississippi?
Yes.
And
yes,
the mayor,
Chokwe Lumumba, is going to be there.
He's going to be there.
Obviously AOC and Warren would be excellent, but he would be great to get.
We're going to see if we can do that. I don't know when these people come in, and I'm not going to stay. It's a little bit pricey, and so we're just going to go down for 2 days. But that's just a little house cleaning for the rest of the week. But before we get to Thursday and Friday, of course, we need to first traverse through Tuesday. And that is when the Michael Brooks Show happens.
So on this Tuesday's show, as always, there's all of the segments in the show. And this Tuesday's guests are Anna Kasparian of the Young Turks. We are doing this has actually already been recorded. I'm trying to think of the least vulgar way of putting this, but the whole tearing of Dave Rubin is pretty amazing that Anna and I managed to produce together. The fusion of my just sort of general disrespect for him and Anna's personal experience with him is...
The Koch brothers are trying to Watergate into this office to try to destroy recording because it's going to destroy his career.
It is
really
it is the ether of YouTube segments between progressive talk show hosts. And then Bree Joy is in studio. We're talking about Sorry to Bother You and her trip with AOC and Bernie to Kansas. And then I just want to say on Sunday for patrons, we did an illicit history of trade with Zach Carter from Ricardo to Trump, which really good example type of stuff you get at patreon.com/TMBS.
A lot for the Keynes lovers, isn't it?
Yes, Keynes actually, he's writing a bio of Keynes, which I'm really excited to read.
Just Zach a bio? Carter, just like a full biography or just
no,
a
just
bio?
No, just a bio. It's a tweet thread.
It's for a new website.
Yeah, it's for a new website. It's called King. It's called bio.org.
Rad Economist.
Rad Economist. That actually would be
extremely
cool.
Dense paragraph.
It's just like a little website with graphs on like Marx and Keynes. That would be cool, actually.
Jamie, what's the latest with the Antifada?
Well, we have our most recent episode out that is a lot about Marxist feminism and the National Welfare Rights Organization of the 60s and 70s, which it was mostly women of color and came around to some very radical anti-work politics through collective struggle. And we talk about that. Also, our YouTube channel is now up. It is called The Antifada Podcast. And our latest...
How'd you come up with that name?
I don't know. Sean did. You can ask him. But it has all our latest episodes on there, and the older ones should be up soon. Also, we're recording a new episode this evening with our friend Brandon Jordan, who makes documentaries on global uprisings all over the world. Some of his footage was actually featured in Sorry to Bother You, and we should have a good conversation with him.
There you go. And Matt?
Yeah, deep into Hawthorne on a Literary Hangover with a Young Goodman Brown last weekend. And this upcoming weekend, we're doing The Maypole of Marymount.
Why do you laugh, you Philistine? What's
well, it's just
you?
Like I love how hippie, just like we're deep into Hawthorne. Right.
I'm a brochurist literature podcaster.
That is perfect self-description. No debate about that, buddy.
646-257-3920 is the number if you want to participate
Hawthorne
in the
is pretty
program.
Cool. Dude, here's lessons about capitalism here. Waterboat.
We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.